things I want to talk about today is this: storytelling in digital humanities. And people who know me will know I will always talk about fiction as well. So even real world stuff for me is very much connected to fiction. And I'm one of the people who does a bit more fundamental stuff today. So just reflecting a little bit on, when we talk about digital humanities, what is it we actually mean? Because there are so many things we can do in digital humanities. So we can archive stuff. What we do can be about preserving things, making stuff accessible. And here, for instance, this is a manuscript that Charles Dickens wrote, and manuscripts are very precious things that we want to conserve, and therefore digitization is a very important bit. But just archiving, preserving isn't enough. We also then need to study what's going on. And it's about creating as well and experiencing. So here the example of the 3D printing is that sometimes when you go to museums, it's all nice and well if everything is behind glass, but it's also about experiencing. And so some of the digital methods that we have can help us experience reality in a new way. It's also about understanding the history, and something I only learned recently, in our Rechenzentrum here, we actually have an old SUSE computer. And you can go there and look. Yeah, we will go and have a look at this, absolutely. Yeah, and the very nice person who looks after that machine is very happy if we come and have a look and get a little demonstration. So this is so cool. So anyway, this is happening here as well. Now, my focus in digital humanities is very much on language and data, and how language can be data, and what data really is, linguistic data, and all of that. And that seems to be a very fashionable thing to do these days. You know, everything is about data. And what you then get an awful lot is people now talk about storytelling when it comes to data. And then you see there are things like this. You probably might have seen something like this, where people say, okay, data science, what we do there is we collect data, we prepare data, then we visualize it, we analyze it, and then we need to tell a story with our data. I think this is a good argument. Yes, if you don't have a story, you can't explain much to people. But I think what we shouldn't forget is, if we take a humanities perspective, the data we looked at already had a story before we turned it into data. And then we kind of pretend that it's just data, a lot of collection, and then afterwards we look at it and think, how am I going to tell a story with the graphs that I now have? And what I want to argue is that we need to make that connection clearer. So, you know, stories don't just turn into data and then you forget the context. We need to look at that context as well. So here are some things I just want to leave with you in the fundamental section. When we talk about writing, writing is not the same as text production. And I will say a little bit about ChatGPT, obviously, at the end as well. Also, reading is not the same as knowledge extraction. It isn't just about, can I summarize this text and know what the three key messages is. Reading is also a process that does lots of other things than coming up with a summary. There's always creativity and criticality involved. So you have the difference between product that might turn into data and process of actually engaging with it as a human being for all sorts of other benefits. So what I want to argue is we still need theoretical foundations, and we also still need qualitative analysis, however many computers we have and however many programs we can apply. And what I want to talk about today is basically three principles of creativity. So that is a bit like stuff that I would do in Introduction to Digital Humanities week 1 and 2, but very quickly today in less than half an hour, hopefully. A good example for this is to take a text that everyone or a lot of people know, so you won't be surprised if we just look at this for a tiny little moment. If we look at that text, some words that are interesting to count and look at are unsurprisingly words like which here from the Oxford English Dictionary, when you want to look at the definition, is a female magician, a sorceress, and in later use, especially a woman supposed to have dealings with the devil or evil spirits. Okay, that's an interesting one. If we look at the male counterpart, we have a wise man. Slightly evaluative, a little bit different in terms of, you know, no comment. But what's interesting is if we now look at this in general language, and my go-to place for general language is always the British National Corpus. So this is taken from the older version, but there's a newer version as well, and it doesn't change much. If you look at the British National Corpus and you count all the occurrences of wizard and witch, you will find that put together, the percentage for the female form is more frequent than the male form. And that seems to have something to do with the fact that we've got this little bit of evaluative meaning going on here, okay? If we then look at the corpus, this is a bit small, but I explain what it is, that is the Oxford Corpus of Children's Literature. And children's literature published after 2000. So we did some work with the University of Oxford where they've got this Oxford Corpus, and it's just, you know, the stuff that you can buy in Waterstones. And if you look at that, it's also that somehow witches are better for fictional stories than wizards. And if you go further back in history, in 19th century, even more so, okay? So we see there's a bit of a change, you know, older stories, more witches, more recent, less so. And you can also then relate this if you just look at the pronouns in these books and see is there maybe a gendered relationship as well. And we've used the pronouns kind of as proxies for male and female characters or people. And then you see that it turns round, you know, so there you have more male people characters and fewer female people, but you have more witches than wizards. Well, what that's anyway, now here are my first fundamental things, three principles of creativity. The first one is the principle of minimal departure. When you deal with fiction, we assume that unless the text tells us otherwise, the fictional world is like the real world, because we can't spell out everything in a fictional story. We need to make some assumptions. And what I just showed you about these pronouns, people talk about men more than they talk about women, that has something to do with how we see the world. So all the biases that we have in the real world, we very easily get them in fiction as well. So the argument is that by looking at more than one fictional world, we see evidence of the real world because we just take the patterns from the real world into fiction. Now, why do I all need all this to talk about Harry Potter? If you look at Harry Potter, suddenly, wizard is more frequent than witch. Now you can think about why might this be so? Why do we now have wizard? Well, what's happening there? Any ideas? If you look at the pronouns, it all becomes clear, doesn't it? It's exactly the same. So the male characters are more frequent than the female characters, and what it is in Harry Potter is just that you build this whole Harry Potter world of the wizards and witches, and basically that world works exactly in the same way. Obviously, the men are more frequently talked about than the women, and if you look at concordances, you see the wizard is always the person who's the greatest, the most powerful. You know, with the men, it's about that. And if we look at the witches, witches are mothers, as we would expect, and then they read this top-notch literature like Witch Weekly, which is a bit like OK Magazine or something like that. You know, so no stereotypes spared, yeah? But just showing you this for these principles. Now, what I'm arguing is that you can also still change the world with fiction. We don't need to accept this. It depends on what we do with this. These gendered patterns are patterns that are negotiated in the language, okay? Patterns have to do with evaluative meaning and bias, and patterns occur in fiction. Fiction is the place where we negotiate meanings because we can think about things that could hypothetically take place. If you look at children's literature, there's a lot about how you should represent more diverse families, how you deal with people from different backgrounds. There's a lot of thinking going on. And we looked with some colleagues at these books here. Does anyone know these? Murder Most Unladylike in the UK is the absolute craze at the moment. That is Robin Stevens and everyone. You know, if you've got kids in the UK, you must have these books. So what it is kind of obviously boarding school story, but this time it's two girls who are detectives. And the whole book and the whole, hello, and the whole book and the whole series is really about these girls behaving in a very tough way, solving these murder mysteries. If you look at the murder most unlady, like these are the figures for the pronouns again, there the world is actually changed and turned into something else, because now you have more female characters, so the female pronouns, 68% versus the male pronouns. So here you have a really female world. And then you have texts, text sections that talk about these characters in a way that really stress these gendered situations, stereotypes, things that want to be changed. So here's a typical example, because we looked at the word unladylike, because that's part of the title, and we thought, why is this an interesting word to look at? And if you look at unladylike in general language, again, you get so much, you learn so much about stereotypes and how people think women should behave, sit, walk, think, dress. It is amazing. I mean, if you look at all this, you don't want to get up in the morning anymore, because it's just so complex. But here in the book, you then have things where the book always makes a point of they do something, and that is decidedly unladylike. And that is positive. So doing stuff in an unladylike way is good. So here we've got something, they just have a really great insight into who it might be. And here you see, they also said what she would have called Sherlocky, so from Sherlock Holmes. So they always use things that are typically male to describe what great achievements they come up with. And then at some point she said, Daisy said something extremely unladylike. Obviously the book is PC, so you don't hear what she said, but it was extremely unladylike. So you can imagine which words this might have been. So the unladylike is a point we want to make, and that is the second principle of creativity, that sometimes in the text you highlight parts of the text that receive more emphasis than others, and this textual highlighting creates some psychological foregrounding. So this is a story where really the gender topic, you can't easily escape this, and you have these little parts in the text where something is really highlighted for you to not miss it. Anyway, the next principle I want to show you is something I need to prepare a bit, and that is stories are generally about people. We have, again, in children's books, we have stories where animals are the protagonists, but then funnily enough, these animals always behave like people. So really, stories are about people, and there are typical ways of talking about people and describing people, and body language is a very common ingredient of fiction. So now I want to say something about patterns that are common and typical and repeated, and people who know me will know there's no way of saying this without talking about Click, because that is the web app that we've developed especially for the study of fiction, and I won't go into the details, it has lots of functionalities, but we don't need the functionalities here. I just wanted to see, if you've got a mobile device that is connected to the internet, we could just together quickly look at an example. If you go to clickbmac.uk, our mobile-friendly version, if there is enough Wi-Fi to actually do this, if you go to the clickbmac.uk, you should see something like this. Is that something you can see? If anyone can see it, no, I see Anastasia's nodding, that is good. People in the back, anyone? Yeah, yeah, people in front are nodding, because then if you click on this little box up here, you then get these options. Yeah, the little, here, yeah, that little box. This little box, yeah? You then get options, and of these options, I want you to click on concordance, and then in the concordance, please go to the search the corpora, then you get a little drop down, and you just tick Dickens's novels, and then you put in for the search term the word hens, and then it depends on how your phone works. For some phones you just have to click refresh, for others you have to do other things, but you know your phone, how you make it do. Can you see that? Yeah. And it doesn't, just talk to the person sitting next to you if you're unsure. Does it work? I see some people smiling. Is that desperation or does this mean it works? It's okay. Okay, so you should see then something like this, yeah? And that is what we call a concordance, or similar to what I showed you for wizard and witch. And this is just a sequence of occurrences of the word hence in Charles Dickens. And these occur in the order of the book. And then we have some other fancy functions where you can, for example, quick group and say, I want to see which possessives are in front of or are occurring after the hence or something like this. And then you can see patterns. And the reason why I've used the word hence is there are patterns that occur really repeatedly, not just in one Dickens novel, not just in Charles Dickens, but across fiction. Yeah? And a typical pattern is putting his hands in his pockets. Hello. So putting his hands in his pockets is like something like this, and that is typical male behavior in a lot of fictional texts. And what I wanted to illustrate with this little example is the third principle of creativity. So creativity needs convention as well. So because the language is so patterned, both on lexicogrammatical level and larger levels, we need texts to contextualize with other texts. So we need to spell out what we've already read or heard somewhere else, because otherwise your text will sound extremely weird if you don't make these contextualizing patterns in fiction that you write. Okay? So I hope this is okay for the principles, because now I'll show you a few more examples. Going back to some of the stuff we have done in children's fiction, where we looked at that corpus, the one on the left is the Chilid corpus, so that's 19th century corpus of children's fiction. So this is the classics, you know, Beatrix Potter, Alice in Wonderland, the stuff that we all know and somehow have grown up with. And the other one is the OCC, that is the 2000 onwards, the Oxford Children's Corpus. And for me, this was very interesting because that's the stuff I've read with my son. So the one is the one that I grew up with somehow because it was the classics then. And the other one is the stuff that I've been reading now as a parent, which is very interesting in itself. So what we then did is we said we wanted to find common patterns, repeated patterns, and especially the body language common patterns. So we did something that was super easy, and I'm giving this example because you will know all this. You know, Google Ngram Viewer is something that was hyped when it came out, and I think since then everyone really knows what Ngrams are. So repeated sequences of words, and we wanted to just look at all of them that had possessives in them. So things like his hands in his pockets, his face with his hands, covered his face with his. So we really just checked what sequences of five words can we find where we've got body part nouns and possessives so that we can do a little comparison as to female characters and male characters. One second. So we wanted to compare female and male characters, and we also wanted to compare how things change over time. So what we found is basically in the 19th century fiction, and I can't show you all of this, it's more that female characters are very much defined in relation to male characters. So they throw their arms around other people's neck, or you know, they do things where they grab other people or they look at them. It's really more in relation to, and otherwise you have things like with tears in her eyes or covered her face with her hands or something. You see where this is going. Whereas men are very much like his hands in his pockets and doing things that are really like, you know, everything's possible. If you then look at the more contemporary, you see that this kind of changes. And the patterns we found, that this is important, we just didn't look at these sequences. We also looked at a lot of the context, because context explains the meaning of the pattern. And you could then see that there was behavior of female characters. So the top frequent one is something where female characters stand like this. And then the context describes that these female characters are very self-confident and they're really having a go at the person they are talking to. So it's not like they put their face behind their hands and don't want to speak to them. So it's kind of, you can see how this is a bit different. Then, you all know this, then there was a time in psychology where people then started talking about the Wonder Woman pose and something as a power pose. I mean, this is now old news. I don't think we do this as much anymore. But there are different power poses for men and for women. So if you look something like this, James Bond, he wouldn't stand like this, would he? I mean, imagine Daniel Craig, like, seriously, no. But then you also have later Wonder Woman, which is a bit different from early one. So there's a lot of interesting stuff going on there. What I like most is that people then also talk about real world situations. I don't know whether you remember Theresa May. She was one of the many prime ministers we lived through in the UK. And at some point, she really wanted to present herself as this, you know, I've now got the house in order. And then obviously the press, as the press would do, mocked this immediately. Oh, Theresa May appeared to go for a spot of power posing here, and then obviously with the comment, and it didn't really help. Well, and then you had people like here, David Cameron. That's a really good one. It says the then Prime Minister, David Cameron, went full East End gang boss at a photo shoot. So I don't know if... this is now a bit of a UK joke, but Gavin, you probably might have watched EastEnders at some point. I definitely have. And EastEnders is really, you know, when you see him there, it is almost looks like, you know, Phil or Grant Mitchell or something like this. You just cannot see it somehow. But the press is very good at making fun of these things. Anyway, what I want to say is that there's quite a lot of connection between what you have in fiction and what you have in the real world, either because fiction shows you what happens in the real world, or the real world might then make fun of what you have in fiction to do other things. And this is one I can't talk about, I just give this to you in case you want to look at this. There was a really nice article in The Conversation where they talked about spies are not who you think they are. And that is interesting in the sense, what do we know about spies? A lot of what we think spies are is because we all, or many of us, do watch James Bond movies and enjoy this very much. So we learn about the world also from fiction. So it's not just that the world is reflected in fiction, but we learn about stuff that we don't have direct access to through fiction. Anyway, now I just want to use the last couple of minutes to talk a little bit about how we get from these principles that help us to describe what we find in our data. So the principle of minimal departure, highlighting and contextualizing. These are good principles to analyze data and texts. And what I'm currently very interested in is how do we get from the understanding of text and the analysis of text to the actual production of texts, and how can the patterns that we have identified help us learn to write better or become a novelist, should we want to do this? And that's a little project that I've also been doing with other colleagues that we've called then Click Creative. And you see, we've already changed the font size to make it look more creative, but yeah. Anyway, what we're doing there is we're developing training materials where we use these insights, like things like his hands in his pockets or her hands on her hips, to actually then prepare materials, and especially for children who learn how to write stories, to say, these are things maybe you should be aware of, or give them little examples and say, if someone stands like this, what does this look like? What do you think, what emotion is meant to be expressed in this way? And we then use our concordances as a way of zooming in, so kind of doing a bit of focused reading. So saying, I write a story where I want to write descriptions of eyes or so, and then it's very helpful to run a concordance on eyes and see what actually happens to then get a sense of how could we maybe do this. We then also give them little examples. The important thing for me to mention is it is a portfolio approach. So we are not trying to develop something like these AI writing tools that basically do the job for you, but it's more like you need a set of different things, examples, skills, practices, and this is what we're trying to put into our portfolio. If you have time, we've also done some little videos that you can watch, and this is the kind of handouts we prepare. This was an interesting one where we looked at how do we actually talk about light in fiction? Do we describe light in terms of what we see? So do we think light is a very visual thing? But actually light is something that you also hear and describe. A lot of the importance of light in fiction is the audio of it, kind of. You know, like lighting a match, hearing the fire in the background, having an old oil lamp where the sound is somehow different from electric light. So these are things that we want to use to help teach creative writing. And then we do stuff like this where we actually speak to authors who do write fiction. So we've done an interview with Essie Fox, who's just done a really brilliant book if you're into like gothic stuff, that kind of thing. And then talk about authors, how do you actually learn and do these things. Now I want to show you, I do have to, 2 more minutes, yeah. I want to show you just one example of the stuff that we are currently trying to work on in this whole Click Creative, because you can't help doing stuff. So this is just the handouts quickly. I want to get to the next thing. So that's all the stuff that you can download. But you can't do all this without actually looking at ChatGPT. So we're also trying to see some of these things that we now know because we looked at the patterns. Might these things help us to write better prompts for things like whether that is ChatGPT or any of these other tools? And how would you need to do the prompt writing so that you actually get what you want to get? And some of this is really very strange because in a sense you know exactly what you want to get and then you spend all your time trying to explain this to the thing to see whether it can actually produce it, where I think if I just written this myself. But obviously we need to understand how these prompts can help us because then we can generalize from these insights. And we don't have enough time so that I could show you the longer narrative stuff, so I just show you a very small little example. And that is one from asking the thing to write a little poem or the beginning of a little poem. And that takes us back to the witches from the beginning to think about, okay, what do we get? If we want a little poem about a witch and we want the poem to start by describing what the witch looks like. And also it's a poem for children and ideally written in rhyme. And we don't want more than 2 stanzas for now because we just want to see. Now, have a little read. James, can you just read it for us?
Sure. In a forest deep where the tall trees sway lives a witch with a smile that sparkles like day, with hair like spun gold and eyes bright as dew. In lavender robe, she's both friendly and true. Her broomsticks a dance with a sweep and a twirl. She gathers her dreams in a bright little swirl. With potions of wonder and tales yet untold, she whispers to stars as the night turns to gold.
Okay, on a scale of 1 to 5, who thinks this is a 5-star poem? Hands up. You think it's 5-star poem, okay. Who thinks it's a 1-star poem? Oh, no one. Who thinks it's maybe a 3 or something like this? Yeah, that's kind of a 3-star. So if I did a creative writing class, I would probably say good start, but maybe there are some things we got to work on. And it also, funnily, I mean, again, I don't know how much UK TV you guys watch, but it sounds to me very much like the Aldi Christmas ad. You know, no. Because they always do this, like, yeah, then Kevin the Carrot and bloody blah goes somewhere and does it. You know, that is the kind of like easy something something. And what I was thinking when I tried to give the thing the prompt was really this one. Do you know that one? James, do you want to read that as well?
The witch had a cap and a hat that was black and long ginger hair in a braid down her back.
This is a poem for children, and that gets really exciting and interesting. And some of the really exciting and interesting that happens there is actually the cat. So the witch had a cat. So it's not just about the hat that was black, but it is about the cat. Everything else is just there to rhyme with cat, really. But you see how that is already a bit of a different opening from the other ones, where you get everything that we've always heard about witches put together in as many words as we need. And here, Julia Donaldson, who's absolutely brilliant for children's literature, you see how she sets up the very beginning of the poem in the first line by putting in the cat. And that is one thing, that is part of the stuff I'm trying to do at the moment, is trying to think about narrative in terms of also the sequencing. It isn't just about putting patterns together because they have been set somehow, but you need this connection of you're actually wanting to arrive somewhere. So it's good and well if stuff like, Gavin, you mentioned this pseudo-write, writes a little chapter for you, but if you don't know where you want to end with this, it's neither here nor there. And there's a lot of editing and doing stuff like this. Anyway, this, I just wanted to give you something. This is work in progress, but you see what's currently happening, so you might want to come back to this. And if you have ideas and if anyone is interested in getting into any of this, just let me know. So some conclusions quickly. What I hope I have shown is that language is not the same as data. So rather than putting the bricks together, having the house and telling the story after, I would very much argue and say, let's not forget the stories while we're actually looking at it. Also, language is where society negotiates its value system. The fact that we have evaluation biases is something that is a snapshot at any one point in time, but it doesn't have to stay like this, and fiction is a place to help change this. Language really appears in the form of stories, and stories and narratives, they can be fictional or non-fictional. So my James Bond example and spies and all the rest of it and East End gang bosses, these boundaries are very fuzzy, and therefore fiction also can change the world, I strongly believe. For me, as a corpus linguist, I think we can provide theories and background stuff that we need to make sense in this age of AI that we're currently in. This was the last bit with that we need to think about the patterns and stuff we learn and what that can do in the world where ChatGPT could take over a lot of the writing and the production. But here the question is, why do we do this? Language always has a purpose. Do we write because we need a lot of text so that we have an awful lot of data to analyze, or do we write because there's a purpose for that text? And that is something I want you to think about, and there will be more on the things I've just mentioned somewhere here at some point. Okay, and this is where I want to finish.